Real men at their best. Real men at their best. That's the title of this message. And I would like to open by asking a couple penetrating questions. Is masculine chivalry dead? Is masculine chivalry dead, or can it be revived? And is Father's Day an empty ritual, or is that a significant day? What makes the male gender a man? And what makes the same male a man in the sight of his wife or his girlfriend? Where does one find admired identity? True masculinity can and should be a virtual reality in our families and in the church, as we shall see. One of the reasons I'm glad, again, we are reviving the Spokesman's Club, because that does emphasize a number of masculine traits. But I think we all understand that masculinity and fatherhood is under heavy attack in this country. And you go to Isaiah 3 and verse 12, where it states, I'll just quote that, children are their oppressors and women shall rule over them. And the sad commentary, the resounding question that arises from this to me are, where are the men? Where are the men? So many women lead by default, because if they don't step in a vacuum, a leadership vacuum, then nobody does, and you have collateral damage. But over in Isaiah, since I've just mentioned it, I will turn over to Isaiah 3 and verse 1. Symptomatic of the culture and the time in which we live. Isaiah chapter 3 and verse 1, we read, for the Lord of hosts does take away from Jerusalem and from Judah. And this also can extend to modern day Israel too, and that would include the peoples of this country. Taking away from these areas, or allowed to be taken away, the stay, the staff, the whole stay of bread, in the way of water, certain physical blessings to be removed. And also, part of this, the mighty man, the men of war, the judge, the prophet, the prudent, the ancient, the captain of 50, honorable men, people that were very, very capable, in other words. And it goes down to the cunning artificer and the eloquent orator. These are huge commodities that are at a premium in a time when the country is strong, but when it's floundering and weak and you have a dearth of talent, a dearth of leadership, then you have a chaos. And it says in verse 4, by default, I will allow or give children to be their princes, and babes shall rule over them. And we see sometimes people that are very childish assume roles of responsibility. And if you look at the campaign trail, one thing is for sure, it's not eloquent. You don't see eloquent people. You see a lot of name-calling and a lot of mudslinging, but it's just part of the trend of the times. And even if it be that way, we in the church have to embrace what is valuable and hang on to it and develop it. And masculinity is certainly in short supply in society, and real men are very rare. Hopefully not in the church. Certainly we can do better. Father's Day brings to mind the need for honoring true, genuine service and leadership within the family. And where Father's Day is meaningful is where that is being applied. I think it's good on a day like this weekend, Father's Day weekend, to consider that. Now, because women have been very valuable, Mother's Day seems to get more than honorable mention. There's a great deal of appreciation for mothers, and certainly that makes all the sense in the world. Sometimes it's hard to call across the country to get a hold of a mom. Not so on Father's Day. But on Mother's Day, it can be that way. Now, there are different people that are outspoken feminists that are critical of men. And when I study their lives, I conclude, you know what? I can't blame them, at least when I see where they've come from. I can understand how people could make statements. Well, I hate men. Well, if I had their lives, maybe I'd be saying that too. If I was exposed to what they were, I can remember one woman saying that, coming into the church, and she said, you know what? I had to change my whole concept of who God was. I had to consider him not as God the Father, because of the bad examples that I had in my extended family, but when I think of the male figure and God the Father, I had to think of him as my adopted father, that he was different than any other role model person that I, the masculine or male role model that I ever saw. But most women will tell you by default they would prefer not to lead, but unfortunately in some cases felt compelled to fend for themselves or were abandoned and had no choice. And that is so common in this world and in this society. I think of there's multiple thousands of children, for example, in the metro system of certain countries, like in Moscow. They don't have anybody. And that's tragic. God will come back and he's going to right the wrongs. It says a pure religion and undefiled, James 1:27, is to reach out to the widows and to the fatherless. And God has a great place in his heart for them. And it won't always be this way. But when I look at and read the experiences of Rosie O'Donnell or Gloria Steinem that would argue that Father's Day is basically a waste of time, or as one of them said, a woman and a man are about have as much in common as a bicycle and a fish, which is nothing. That's not true, but their orientation for them, it was that way. And by default, because of very, very trying upbringings and experiences they had nothing but frustration over the male examples that they saw. Now, anyone who has ever watched Jerry Springer knows that anybody can be a father. However, being a husband and a dad is one of the highest honors, one of the highest responsibilities that one could have. We live in a very selfish world, 2 Timothy 3. So many males are self-absorbed, females too, but maybe men more. Women seem to excel at relationships, but men certainly can if they try. God intended for there to be strong, loving leadership in the family, in society, and he expected it to start with a man. Yet very few males have ever had any training on how to become a father. It usually goes by example, whether it's good or bad. And every day, 300,000 males become first-time fathers in the world. In the U.S., only 40 or up to 40% or more of children are not with their biological dads. How many males are taught to be men? Very few. There's enormous instruction in the Bible, and there are other good works, books that are available that highlight that Christian with Christian value. So, are there many real fathers left? Are there, and this is a major question, are there potentially marriageable men that want to be masculine in the right way, that want to be servants in the right way? Let he that is chief among you, Matthew 20:27, be your servant. Yes, there are times, maybe to make a final executive decision where you're at the top of the pyramid, so to speak, but Christ is the head of the church. And he may be out in front leading, but virtually all of his time is spent at the bottom helping people, serving people, caring about people. And when you do that and you're in tune with the needs of people, then you may be able to make the right decision or make a decision based on the input and the experiences that you have being involved. But how can males become real men at their best? How can they become real men at their best? And the answer, by developing the spiritual qualities of steel and velvet. Developing the spiritual qualities of steel and velvet based on biblical principle. I rely on the Bible for so much of this material, but I will cite a very good book that came out about 30 years ago entitled Man of Steel and Velvet, highlighting spiritual aspects of strength and sensitivity. And it points out that a male cannot be a complete man or cannot be an eligible person for marriage without the ability to be strategically strong where one's necessary and strategically sensitive and patient at the right times. A man needs to be both. He needs to be both. He needs to be steel and velvet. In this society of instant gratification and unbridled greed, good fathers are rare. But the ones that are good, while being in the minority, often go unsung, unpraised, unnoticed, and unappreciated. But they're heroes. And they could involve and include everybody here. We can't change what goes on out in society, in a self-absorbed, selfish world, but we can here. We can promote it, appreciate it, inspire it, thank those that do it, encourage children. Father's Day is an opportunity for the church to say, we endorse masculine male leadership, that rare commodity, the commodity that was intended to hold society together. Women are marvelous. They hold so much of society as we see it today, and if it weren't for them, then it would be total chaos. But masculinity has always been an issue. In Ezekiel 22 and verse 30, take a look at that. Ezekiel 22 and verse 30. Ezekiel 22 and verse 30. It says, and I saw it for a man, this is God speaking, among them. This was a difficult time in Judah's ancient history when it was apostatizing, big time. I saw it for a man among them that should make up the hedge and to stand in the gap before me and the land that I should not destroy it. But I found none. Now Abraham wanted to stand in the gap for Sodom and Gomorrah. And Noah stood in the gap for the world. You know, if people would have just listened, even if a fraction of the people would have listened to Lot, Abraham's nephew, you know, the history of the world could have been changed. God is not waiting for every last person to come to a point of repentance, but if different people would. But in Judah's case, nobody did, and it went into captivity, just like its cousin Israel. But God said, basically, I was looking for a few strong men. Sounds like the Marines. There was one recruitment assembly in a high school one time. It was about an hour long, and the different services were represented. And one man represented the Army, and he talked for about 20 minutes, and somebody the Coast Guard, and then another person the Air Force, trying to encourage people to recruit, and the Marine recruiter only had about 1 minute, and then the assembly was over. So he got up and he said, not many of you would probably be interested. I don't think but more than 4 or 5 have what it takes. But if anybody wants to be a Marine, see me afterwards. And the whole place flooded over to his table. At least it was popular, the idea, but how many people were willing to pay the price to be in any of the services at that point? Well, God is always looking for quality leaders, and they have to stand in the gap from time to time, make a difference for other people, maybe reach out to the disadvantaged, those around them, have a deep sensitivity, maybe for those that don't have dads. You know, in 1909, there was a woman by the name of Sonora Dodd, and she was listening to a Mother's Day sermon at a church that reflected on wonderful virtues that mothers demonstrated. And she sat there, and she wasn't detached from the message, but she thought, you know what? My mom died very early in my life. And she said, but I had a fantastic dad. He was always there. He was my mother and father. And he took care of us. And he was brilliant. He was, you know, everything to me. And she was the one that decided to start up a Father's Day. So in Spokane, Washington, June 19th, 1910, the country observed or witnessed its very first Father's Day. And when it caught on in popularity in the 1920s, President Calvin Coolidge proclaimed that this Father's Day would be a national holiday, and all those who had fathers that were alive would wear red roses that particular Sunday, and those whose fathers were no longer alive would wear white roses. And there have been some great fathers, some from the Bible, for example. And I would say that these people were a blend of steel and velvet, and I will elaborate in some detail on that. Let's take the example of Abraham. Abraham was a real man, living God's way. He was a servant. He was a leader. According to Josephus, he had the courage of his conviction in Babylon, where people believed in many gods. He said there's only one. And he said, and he was an astronomer and was able to prove God's existence, as I recall. He had a lot of knowledge about the celestial bodies. And he went to Egypt and was able to make the same statements there. Was an astronomer, was a statesman, was respected, and well, even before God called him. But he was called at the age of 75, when some people would say, well, you know, I think it's time to wind down. And he said, God, whatever you want, wherever I will go, I will do. And he had a sensitivity about the people around him. We know that he was concerned about Lot, and he was correct when he said, God, would you destroy the righteous with the wicked, with Sodom and Gomorrah? He did care about people. And a real person, a real man, is going to do that. And in Genesis 26 and verse 5, you can turn there if you wish. Genesis 26 and verse 25, it says, because Abraham obeyed my voice, says God, and kept my charge, my commandments and my statutes and my laws. Verse 4, I'll make his seed to multiply as the stars of heaven and give countless blessings to him. But he was a man that was tender, and he felt for people. He did what he could for people. He pleaded for people's lives when he negotiated with God. And yet he understood the God's way was also a way of steel as well as velvet. Mercy as well as punishment. And Abraham understood the balance of appreciating both inclinations. Noah was another man that was phenomenal. He was constant. He was reliable, just like Abraham. Same person, day in, week out. Didn't fall to pieces. Didn't make excuses. Fall to pieces. He could have. Under heavy persecution, what would it be like today to build an ark, let alone back then? Longer than a football field, and announced to the world that a big flood was coming, and there was an important, we'll build this in Dade City, up on high ground, and be ready for the big flood that's coming. Well, anybody that would do that would be under heavy persecution interest. Oh no, another James Jonestown problem. A cult's building an ark. How crazy is that? Well, it is crazy unless God commands it. If God knew something that mankind didn't, Noah understood it. He didn't lash out at the crowd. You just can't criticize me for this. How can you get down on me? You know, I'm keeping people employed. I'm building this ark. Not that way. He was consistent. He had the vision to complete the assignment. He was close to God. And according to other secular accounts, perhaps spent a considerable amount of time warning society about that. Other people that were a mix of steel and velvet, real men, Hosea, the prophet Hosea, who was consistent. He was not up and then down, but consistent. He was there for his wife. He was there for his children. He was a leader with winning results. He was so dependable. When his wife Gomer was not dependable, he reached out for her. He brought her back. into the fold, provided her with everything that she needed. It was an unusual assignment that God had given him, but he handled it well. There are other notables in the Bible that were a blend of steel and velvet. They were strong and they were tender. Able to make hard decisions, stand up to public pressure, and gentle, and not willing to break a little twig to reach out to people. These are men. These are people that are valuable. These are people that we would honor if they were alive for Father's Day. Boaz, who married Ruth, he was wise. He trusted God. He was a leader in his region, but he was tender. He was considerate of the disadvantaged. He told his men, "You see that woman? You see those people? Leave a little bit of extra grain when you're harvesting, just so that they'll be able to collect something for their families." Other people didn't do that, but a real man would do that. A real man is aware of the needs around him, not just his family, but other people. You think the church needs people like that? You think our spokesman club could use people like that? You think that our old worldwide effort? Absolutely. Absolutely. Women are valuable. The men need to be valuable as well. Another person besides Boaz, we've looked at Hosea, Noah, and Abraham. There's Joshua. You know what happened to ancient Israel after Joshua and the leaders of Israel died? It was chaos, the time of judges. But when Joshua was alive, just like when Moses was alive, Joshua was a consistent leader, made few mistakes, kept saying to everybody, "Be strong and of good courage." Joshua, I think, 1 verse 7. Be strong and of good courage. And that statement repeats in that book of Joshua. Be strong and of good courage. If he told it to his countrymen, I'm sure he told it to his family, reassuring his wife, his children. God is God. He takes care of us. Let us be of good courage. He was the one that said that even when he and Caleb went to the promised land, and they were part of the spies that searched out the area, and they came back with the report, "We can take it. Yes, there are giants, but we can. Those other spies are telling you that we can't. No, it is our land to gain. They had vision. They saw the need. He was a great leader. Perhaps the most the most underrated father in the history of civilization is somebody I want to speak about next. I wonder, can anybody guess who that would be? I've got one hand. Who do you think? God the Father? No, I'm talking about in human fathers. Who would be maybe the greatest and yet the most overlooked father? Yes. Joseph, the father of Jesus Christ. Now, think of it from God's point of view, God the Father. I'm going to have the Son of Man be born in a manger in Bethlehem, and I can't just have anybody be his parents. They have to be people that are firm, that are loving, that will guide, that will encourage a love of the Bible, and set the right tone, the right climate. And I need two people, and I realize if any two people I choose are not going to be perfect, but they've got to be special. They've got to be special. And in Joseph's case, he had to diplomatically handle some challenges very, very well. And that would demand intelligence, patience, and character. The amazing thing about Joseph is we do not have a single statement in the Bible that he ever said. He was quiet. And his example spoke through his great character. We don't have time to turn to every aspect of these people's lives. But he was just. He was a protector. When he found out that Mary was pregnant, he didn't understand. But he didn't fly off the handle. Well, How could you do that? He took it in stride. And then he apparently was able to come to an understanding that this was of God. And so it was something that he did not anticipate. And he could have divorced her outright, and many people would have, in that society especially. But instead, he wanted to protect her. He didn't. If he was going to be forced to put her away, it would be privately, and this was according to the customs of the time. He was extremely considerate. He was a provider. He was a carpenter of sorts, passing on his trade, as we think, to his son Jesus. And there was a time when God commanded that Joseph, Mary, and Jesus flee to Egypt because wicked King Herod wanted to put to death all the children that were 2 years old and younger. And so they did. They believed God. They went and were protected. And when it was time to come back, God told them, and they did. Pure obedience. There wasn't time to hem and haw about it. Well, you know, I believe in God, but boy, this is a little bit over the top. I need some more time to think this one out. I need a few more interventions, you know, maybe a burning bush or five of them so that I'll know that this is really God's will. But Joseph simply followed suit, did what God wanted. Very, very considerate. There's another person that I find that's interesting over in Mark 5. And this person may not have been converted, or maybe became, I don't know. Bible doesn't say. But in Mark chapter 5, we read the account of somebody else that was quite special. He was a rabbi. And he knew and obviously paid attention to a new Christ. I believe this is in Mark chapter 5. Verse 22, Mark 5:22. And Christ was busy with his disciples, interfacing with so much of society. Verse 22, in the middle of the day, behold, there came one of the rulers of the synagogue, Jairus by name. And when he saw Christ, he fell at his feet. Now that's highly unusual, because many people that were in leaders of the Jews, leaders religiously, didn't like Christ. They didn't believe in him, what he talked about. And in fact, the Sanhedrin, the Pharisees, Sadducees, were greatly at odds with Jesus Christ. And Jairus, by going to him and even kneeling in front of him, was risking his reputation as a leading rabbi near Capernaum or Decapolis, right around the Sea of Galilee is where this occurred. Verse 23, and he besought him greatly. Maybe other people would have winced and said, well, Jairus is creating a scene. He shouldn't be adulating Christ that way. But he besought him greatly, saying, my little daughter lies at the point of death. I pray you, come and lay your hands on her that she might be healed and that she might live. I'm amazed he had the kind of faith that he did. He believed in this man Jesus. He'd heard about him, maybe seen his work. And he says, you know, I have a daughter, and that daughter means so much to me, and I will go to the end of the earth to take care of her. But I can't. I don't know how to heal her, but you can. And I'm not going to let you get away. I'm begging you. And that was the compassion that he had for his family. And Jesus went with him, and much people followed and thronged him. And Christ eventually got there and did heal her. That was a wonderful blessing. Jairus was not afraid to seek Christ. He risked his reputation. And he had humility, an absence of pride, deep concern for his family. I know we have people here that are marvelous examples of deep concern for family. Well, Jairus didn't turn into a marshmallow under public scrutiny. The word father is from the Greek word pater, and it means nourisher, protector, upholder. I talk about steel and velvet. And the Carl Sandburg, a famous historian, His specialty was Abraham Lincoln. He loved to study and write about Abraham Lincoln. And Carl Sandburg called Lincoln the man of steel and velvet, and that he had both traits in abundance. And he said, "Not often in the story of mankind does a man arrive on the earth who is both steel and velvet. Some people are one and some are the other. There are many, many dictators that are steel, and they rule with a rod of iron and have made life miserable in some cases, many cases for people. And there have been people that are soft and velvet, but they don't have any backbone. And that can be the other ditch." But he said, "Not often in the story of mankind does a man arrive on the earth who is both steel and velvet, who is as hard as a rock and as soft as a drifting fog." I'd like to read a couple accounts or observations from Audrey Andelin, who writes this book, Man of Steel and Velvet. And early in the book, lays out the parameters here. It says, "The ideal man has strength, endurance, and temperance of fine steel. He is a composite of many sterling qualities. Foremost among them is his willingness to assume masculine burdens, to earn his bread by the sweat of his face, and thus properly provide for himself and family. He is the one who takes pride in this masculine responsibility. He delights in the opportunity to prove his manhood and serves with enthusiasm and honor. He does not face his duty sullenly as though there were no escape, nor does he lean on society for sustenance. When his problems become difficult, he takes pride in trying to solve them himself. Only in emergencies does he look to others for solutions. In no way does he shirk back from this responsibility to protect and provide for his wife and family. He is happy to shoulder this obligation, not only for his moral responsibility to do so, but for the feeling that manliness can give. If placed in a position where he cannot function in this important capacity, he is most uncomfortable. The feeling of responsibility to his family provides substance to the faith with which his wife places in him. When she leaves the security of her parents' home to make her way with him, she must rely on his sense of duty to provide for her, to shield her from her harshness of the world, to provide strength in her new experience. Not only does he assume responsibility for himself and family, but he is also a, quote, builder of society. He recognizes the world's urgent needs, and with a sense of social responsibility contributes his measure to making the world a better place. He is not afraid of great responsibility, even when it requires time, toil, and personal sacrifice. All this he does because of his feeling of moral obligation to others, and he does so without complaint. A man of steel is a masculine man. He is aggressive, determined, decisive, and independent. He learns, not independent of God, though. He learns the efficiency in the affairs of a man's world, demanding quotas of himself and reaching an objective. He is competent in a task, fearless and courageous in the face of difficulty, a master of the situation. He has deep convictions and steadfastly holds to those convictions. He sets high goals for himself, goals that require dedication and patience. He is not afraid of strain and diligence. He rejects softness and timidity. When he has made a decision based on the best of his judgment, he is unbendable as a piece of steel. These qualities of masculinity set him apart from women and children and weaker members of his own sex. A man of steel has sterling character. He remains steadfast to his convictions, even under pressure. Now, as I read this, I realize these are the values of everyone here. He is a man of honor and integrity. He is fair, just, honest in his dealings, possessing moral courage and self-dignity. And of all those diamond traits which make up a strong character, he becomes master of himself through a conscious effort to incorporate the virtues of strong character in his life. When subjected to pressures, he stands firm. In addition to all of this, he has achieved a feeling of confidence and peace within which comes from his personal victory over himself. And physically, the man of steel has a body of strength and skill. I don't know of any woman that wouldn't want that in her man. Then there's the velvet. The velvet qualities include a man's gentleness, his tenderness, kindness, generosity, and patience. He is devoted to the care and protection of women and children. He understands and respects their gentle nature and recognizes it as a compliment to his manliness. He is chivalrous, attentive, and respectful to the gentler sex, and has an ability to love with tenderness. He has, in addition, an enthusiastic, youthful attitude of optimism which defies the press of years. Humility is also part of velvet, subduing masculine ego as his rough nature is refined. In considering the function of steel and velvet traits combined, they may be compared to a large, tall building. The steel qualities relate to the sturdy framework of steel and concrete, which ties the structure together and anchors it to the foundation. Without that strong inner frame, the building would not hold. But the velvet relates to the building's decor, its art forms, landscape, interior finishings, which add softness and beauty to the otherwise stark and stern mass of steel and stone. When properly blended, these traits of steel and velvet compose the ideal man, a masterpiece of creation and the greatest contribution to the well-being of society. The attributes characterized as steel are the framework of his being, demonstrating a steadfastness and purpose born in the self-respect a man feels when he's true to himself, when the quality of his life is such that he can live comfortably with himself as his own best friend. This produces confidence analogous to the strength of a bar in steel, which is thoroughly refined and tested. When the velvet is added, the masterpiece results. The firmness that otherwise might appear too harsh is softened. It is not unlike the large, heavy hands which have been trained to play the violin. Such hands carry the raw strength to crush the instrument in a moment. But there is no danger of such a thing, as the gentle strokes used in bringing forth the beautiful music demonstrate a softness and appreciation for the artistic. Both the steel and velvet are necessary to produce great character. There has never been a truly great man on the earth that was not a possessor of both. Alexander the Great, he was a man of steel. He wasn't great. But having both characteristics is vital. There are notable people that have done that in the past. In the 1930s, there was Al Capone. He had a $120 million empire back then, when money was considerably more expensive or valuable than it is today. $120 million out of Chicago. Along came 26-year-old federal agent Elliot Ness, and he put together a team of, he worked for the federal government, and he worked with a team of nine incorruptible men to bring down Capone. And Ness's salary was just $2,800 a year. Now, that was somewhat significant even in the 30s, but that's what it was. And his staff was very successful in putting a crimp on Al Capone's operation. One day, a man walked into Elliot Ness's office, handed him an envelope. He opened it up. There were two crisp $1,000 bills. And the man said, if you lay off Capone, you'll get one of these every week. Every week. And just an enormous amount of money. Ness waited till he was done, rejected it, and then called for an immediate press conference and said, I've been offered a bribe. This is $2,000, and I could get this every week if we just lay off of one of the most evil, corrupt Americans to this country's ever seen. I just want you people in the press to know what we're up against. And the next day, there was a huge headline Perhaps it was the Chicago Tribune, but the headline said, Ness and his men are untouchable. And there was a TV program ages ago called The Untouchables. And that's where that came from. He would not compromise. He was a man of steel in that regard. In Proverbs 20 and verse 7. By the way, just to clue you in all candor and honesty, as I read all these traits, if I waited until I became 100% of all of that, it'd be many, many years before I would ever dream of even presenting that. It'd probably be at the end of the millennium. But this material has to be given. Proverbs 20 and verse 7. Proverbs 20 and verse 7 says, the just man walks in his integrity. His children are blessed after him. God appreciates people that have the courage of their convictions and stand for what's right, especially in a world where most people don't. I'm appalled in the political arena how people promise one thing and bend and change and attack each other. Just sad. In his book, Living Above the Level of Mediocrity, Chuck Swindoll says, the world needs men. Men that cannot be bought, whose word is their bond. Hey, if I say I'll do something, I'll do it. If I say I'll be there, I'll be there. Put it in the bank. Who put character above wealth. Who possess opinions and a will. Who are larger than their vocations. Who do not hesitate to take initiative. Who will not lose their individuality in a crowd. Who will be as honest in small things as in great things. That's very biblical. He that is faithful in that which is least can be faithful in that which is great. Who will make no compromise with wrong, whose ambitions are not confined to their own selfish desires, who will not say they do it because everybody else is doing it, who are true to their friends though through good report and evil report, in adversity as well as prosperity, who do not believe that shrewdness, cunning, and hard-headedness are the best qualities for winning success, who are not ashamed or afraid to stand for the truth when it is unpopular. You know, that can inspire great confidence. When you think of God the Father, He is both steel and velvet. He can pronounce a major curse on a country and say, I will have to spank ancient Israel. But then He can be pleading and say, oh, Israel, how can I give you up? Oh, Jerusalem, I would gather you like a hen gathers its chicks in deep compassion. Hebrews 13:5, I will never leave you. No, not even forsake you. He's a loving God. I mean, He's passionate. He knows when a sparrow falls to the earth. God is both velvet and steel. Steel we can see in Isaiah 46. Isaiah 46, verses 9 through 11. Isaiah 46, 9 through 11. Remember the former things of old? For I am God, and there is none else. I am God, and there is none like me, he says. Declaring the end from the beginning and from ancient times, the things that are not yet done, my counsel shall stand, I shall do my pleasure, my will. Calling a ravenous bird from the east, the man that executes my counsel from a far country, yes, I have spoken it, I will also bring it to pass. I have purposed it, I will do it. Whether it's the creation of the universe, or the establishment of the holy days and what that means. Establishing Christ to be the perfect sacrifice. To make decrees. God is steel. But He's also velvet. Psalm 103. Psalm 103, verses 13 to 15. Psalm 103, 13 through 15. It says here, like as a father pities His children, so the Lord pities those that fear Him. For He knows our frame, He remembers that we're dust, thankfully. As for a man, his days are like grass, the flower of a field that just withers, and comes and goes. Verse 17, but the mercy of the Lord is from everlasting to everlasting to those that fear or have God, worship God in awe. His righteousness unto his children's children. He is kind. He's tender. He cares. He can roar with thunder and lightning, or he can whisper and penetrate. God is both velvet and steel. Abraham Lincoln was considered both velvet and steel. Back in the Civil War, he took exercise executive powers that had never been done before. He was the first president to command and expect and enforce a draft to be able to wage a war for the Civil War. And he took other executive powers. And that surprised some people, but he did it. And then one time, he was when the war was not going very well, he was introspective, and to one of his friends he said, you know what? Here it is. It's so ironic, he says. I'm the kind of person, I couldn't take the head of a chicken and break it off. And here I am in the middle of this war, in the middle of all of this blood. And it bothered him. It wasn't unusual to see Abraham Lincoln cry and weep. It almost made it legitimate. But he cared. He wrote incredible notes to people. It wasn't just the Gettysburg Address. There was a woman who had 5 sons from the Civil War. She lost all of them. And he felt compelled to write her a letter. And he says, words escape me, but they really didn't. He says, difficult for me, I wish I brought it, I can't begin to understand how you feel to have given such a great sacrifice for the touchstone of freedom. But he was a complete man in every sense. Very unusual characteristics to have at a critical juncture. One of the most important leaders this country had. And where would we be without just one like him that was steel and velvet? Steel translates into providing. Providing. There was a time of difficulty in the early New Testament church where Timothy was, or Paul was compelled to write to Timothy. 1 Timothy. Excuse me, 5 and verse 8. You're familiar with this. But if any not provide for his own, especially those of his own household, is denied the faith, is worse than an infidel. A person that's velvet and steel is not going to let that happen. He's going to do what it takes. There were people, I'll refer to 2 Thessalonians 3, verse 10, that thought, well, the end is coming. We don't have to work anymore. We just wait for the kingdom to come. And Paul says, no, that's not correct. We have to work as isn't and live as if we're going to be here for a long time. But it's important to make that provision, to go all out, to do what it takes. Maybe that means getting a second job, a career change. People can throw up different excuses. There's a lion in the street. Might eat me up. I don't know if I can do that. Well, we have to do what we have to do. That's just being steel. If I have to, I'll wash more windows. I'll collect trash. I'll get a third job. I'll go door to door to sell worms. I mean, you do what you have to do. I'll go to Avila. Go to Tampa Palms. Now, I don't think I'd sell many worms there, but maybe at a fish camp. I mean, you do what you have to do. And we're not in the great tribulation yet. Women naturally tend to want to place themselves in someone else's caring hands. That is huge. And one thing I want to say to our young women that are not yet married, whoever you have in mind, whoever you meet between now and the end of time, and even with a great tribulation coming and other challenges, I think it's God's will that our youth will have families and have that important experience. Whoever you end up thinking about, you find out if they're steel and velvet. If they're all steel, it's not going to be pretty. If it's all velvet, you're going to be one frustrated person. It's got to be both. It's got to be both. You don't want to cheat yourself. You don't want to jump into something and, well, I thought, I assumed. And for all of our young men and for all of us, don't we want to be more of both traits? Don't we want to be the more complete person? I would think so. Sometimes you have to do what it takes. You have to go all out. Counsel maybe, but so important. An enemy of true steel of masculinity is complacency. You know, some people just fritter their lives away with endless, mindless pursuits of fantasy, television. There was a study one time, not that long ago, 100 families were offered $500 if they would forego watching TV for a month. 100 families. 93% of that group turned the offer down. No way! We want to be couch potatoes! Hey, maybe we're soft as velvet, but we sure are not steel. Christ was also velvet and steel. Christ was moved with compassion because they had no shepherd, it says. Another place, I will have mercy and not sacrifice. He says in Matthew 6, behold the fowls of the air, they do not sow or reap, yet your heavenly Father feeds them. How much more important are you than they? I already quoted Hebrews 13:5, I will never leave you nor forsake you. Psalm 23, yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will not fear, for you are with me. It's great that we have a God that we can trust, that we can depend on, that we can communicate to, that is both. Very understanding. Now, I've talked about some of the steel, like Elliot Ness. And then there is the velvet that Christ exemplifies and God the Father. The Apostle Paul also. He was a person that could thunder, you know, preach the word in season and out of season and just be dynamic. But he also had a different side to him, the velvet side. 1 Thessalonians 2. 1 Thessalonians 2. This is quite a statement from somebody that was so loud and dynamic. He said at one point to this audience, 1 Thessalonians 2:7, but we were gentle among you, even as a nurse cherishes her children. So being affectionately desirous of you, we were willing to have imparted unto you not the gospel of God only, but our own souls, because you were dear to us. Remember, brethren, our labor and travail, our laboring night and day because we would not be charged of anything of you. We do want to take advantage of you. And then verse 11, and as you know, we exhorted and comforted and charged every one of you, tried to encourage and guide. Verse 12, that you would walk worthy of God. I mean, that was a whole motive behind our effort to serve you. And that for this cause, we thank God without ceasing, because when you received the word of God, which you heard of us, you received it not as the word of men, but as it was the truth and the word of God, and believed. And so it paid off. But, you know, Paul had a very tender side to himself. Mr. Armstrong, same thing. He could be dynamic. He could thunder out statements. There was one time, though, that I found out that one little girl had written him a little note. Says, dear Mr. Armstrong, she was 10 years old. I just hoped you're having a good day. From one concert lover to another. And that's how she signed it. And he carried it in his vest pocket for 10 years. That meant a lot. Velvet is beautiful when it's mixed with steel. In 1992 in Barcelona, Spain, there was the Summer Olympics. One sprinter, athlete from Great Britain who was running 400 meters. That's once around the track. It's a grueling, grueling race. I know, having run and track, I would much rather run a mile or 2 miles than to sprint 400 meters. That's just tough. I've done it. But Derek Redmond was the British sprinter. And in one of the important races, the gun sounded and he took off with the leaders. And he carried the lead all the way around the backside of the track. And suddenly he felt this horrible sudden pain in the back of his leg. Next thing he knew, he slammed his face, fell over and stumbled and slammed into the track itself. Now, all those years of training just gone, just in the split second. And now, in wincing pain, he stood up and started to hobble, and his whole orientation, got to make it to the finish line, got to make it. And so he was struggling. And out of nowhere popped this one man. He got past security. He was determined. He leaped over the fence and he ran out onto the track and grabbed the athlete. It was his dad. And he says, "Are you serious?" He says, "Yeah, I've got to make it to the finish." And he says, "We're going to do it together." And so he carried him and they went the next 70 yards and the whole arena exploded with applause because this guy had heart. He had just... You know, he wasn't going to give it up. He was going to at least finish what he started. Another example of velvet that goes with the steel. I talk about the nightmare of only being steel. Have you ever seen The Sound of Music, the movie? Captain Von Trapp, how would you like to have him for a dad? He blows the whistle, you know, a certain way, and that's your cue. That's instead of your name. You have to respond to the whistle. It was unfeeling or uncompassionate. We have a wonderful camp that's coming up at Camp Woodman. And there's a lot of encouragement that goes on there. There's certain boundary lines, certain direction, and there's a soft side as well, side of velvet. It's not like Achtung, campers! Welcome to Camp Fossil, where all is in Ordnung. You will be happy here, and there will be no escapes. I went to such a camp once, and this one kid, he was 12, he came running out. He says, "You got to get me out of this prison." That happened. But that you can't have steel alone. You can't have velvet alone. One thing that puzzled me before I came into the church, when I was going to look at other churches, it seemed like Christ especially was presented as such an effeminate figure that I wasn't sure if he was capable of doing anything. And I had it all wrong. He is steel as well as velvet. Final example before closing, I'd like to talk about the prodigal son's father. The prodigal son's father in Luke 15. In fact, I'll turn over there. Now, he didn't exist in reality. He was a creation, a story that was put together by Jesus Christ. And Christ used this example as a teaching tool. And so when he described or gave the story of the prodigal son, you can be sure that when he described the father, that he was going to make sure that the father was described with special abilities and inclinations. And so he's portrayed as both steel and velvet. In Luke 15, we know here that the son decided that he was going to get his inheritance early. And he demanded it from the father. And perhaps the father, being wise and all-knowing, realized, well, if I don't, he's just going to be in this horrible attitude. And that could go on for many, many, many years. And I know if I give this inheritance to him, he's going to waste it. He'll blow it right away. But he'll hit rock bottom. Maybe it's better to hit rock bottom and wake up instead of being festering and being miserable and making other people miserable for years and years and years and just never grow up. Some people never do. So when his son demanded his inheritance, perhaps he surprised him. He said, okay. So right away, his son goes off. Verse 13, and not many days after, the son gathered together, took his journey to far country, and wasted his substance with riotous living. And when he spent all, there was a famine, and he was hungry. And so he started to, he was reduced to virtually nothing, no money. So he got a job feeding animals, feeding the pigs, verse 15. And he realized, verse 16, wow, these pigs, they're eating better than I am. And oddly, being Jewish, you know, he would be dealing with swine. And so then he came to himself and he thought, you know, my father has servants that do far better. I will go arise, verse 18, I'll go back to my dad. For I have sinned against heaven and before you. And I'm no more worthy to be called your son. He rehearsed in his mind, I've done so many things wrong. And the dad, notice, never ran out and scoured. Where is he now? Where is he now? What part of the, what town's he in? Got to find him, got to find him. I've known people that have had concluded, I remember one family, they had a son that was prodigal. In one sense, I mean, he was wasteful, and he was a carbon copy of this person. He was roaming the streets of Las Vegas. He had a drug addiction, and they had bailed him out so many times, and they were frazzled, and they never quit caring. But they told me, you know, he could be anywhere. He's roaming. We've tried everything. He's just going to have to hit bottom. He's just going to have what happened to this prodigal son in order to wake up. We're not going to be used anymore. We're not going to be frazzled anymore. The father understood that he was not to be used. He didn't mind being utilized. He wanted to help his son, but his son had to change. So when the son came back, he lavished every honor on him. He was very, very accepting, much to the jealousy and chagrin of the other brother, which is another story. And then notice verse 32. There was great celebration, he says, for this, your brother, he's explaining to the other one, was dead and he's alive again. He was lost and now he's found. But there was change. He had to wait till there was change. That was steel. Sometimes steel is doing what you're not inclined to do. John Madden was such a great football coach for Oakland for many years. He said one of the secrets to his coaching success, and he won more games than anybody else, he says, sometimes you have to say the opposite of what you feel. You have to be firm. If you're not, everything you work for could just collapse. And he wasn't going to waste years of building this team together and trying to draft the right people in order to let it get so loosey-goosey and helter-skelter that it would collapse. The prodigal son's father was firm. He was optimistic. When it appeared that his son repented, he ran out to meet him. But he wasn't going to go to the next town. I wonder if it's come around yet. That's a challenge. To be compassionate, forgiving, kind, generous, but not soft-headed. Always caring. Always caring. I can't emphasize enough the need for us to have strong families. It's been emphasized by others here and others for many, many, many years. So I'm just one of voice in a long line. There'll be emphasis on these concepts in time to come. But you can't help but understand the impact of when you have caring parents that are both steel and velvet. And when you have a father, and this is what, you know, this weekend's all about, Father's Day. The statistics are quite scary when a father is AWOL. Children were 32 times more likely to run away, 20 times more likely to have behavioral disorders. 85% of youths in prisons are from fatherless homes. Boy, don't we know that in all of our prison visits, in about 8 or 9 places that I've been to. And it comes out sooner or later. Now, people in the church have a huge advantage. They can say, the cycle stops now. The buck stops here. We change those odds. People here can be a success. That's what Spokesman's Club emphasizes. It's what one of the end results of Bible study and church services is that we can rewrite our futures. We can change. We can have the benefit of being steel and velvet and all the blessings that come forth. And by doing that, we're pleasing God. We're in harmony with His laws. That He, being the family man, has us to live those particular principles that He employs and introduces to us. So today we've talked about real men at their best. Women will give the right arm to have someone like that. Those of you that are yet to be married deserve that. You need to hold out nothing less than that. Nothing less. God can work it out. Well, I don't know if there's anybody around here. If God can raise 6,000 people out of Angola, if God can heal people, if God can do miracles of the past, you don't think He can't do them now? He can work things out. When I hear people say, well, I don't know, God doesn't do this for me or whatever, I've never heard anybody with a burning relationship with God that knows steel and velvet and knows that a promise that's made is a promise to be kept, that God does not break His promises. Sometimes, maybe we're not as close to God as we could be. But let's take advantage of the powerful experiences of being in the family of God and knowing that we have God the Father that is steel and velvet. And let us encourage and promote that with our youth. Let us encourage and promote that among ourselves. Let us be the people that God would want us to be. And with God's Holy Spirit, that's possible. Real men at their best.